This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for May 20th, 2024. Helicopter carrying Iran's president has crashed, state media reports. Rescuers are trying to locate the helicopter on which President Ebrahim Raisi and Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian were traveling, state media reported. Their status is unknown. And there's a photograph of the president with the caption, President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran, who was with the country's foreign minister on a helicopter that crashed on Sunday, according to Iran's state media. Photo by Bahi Salimi. By Farnaz Fasihi. A helicopter carrying President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran and his foreign minister crashed on Sunday in the country's mountainous northwest, according to state media, deepening the turmoil that has gripped the nation on both the international and domestic fronts in recent months. Mr. Raisi, 63, was traveling from Iran's border with Azerbaijan to inaugurate a joint dam project. The helicopter carrying Mr. Raisi and Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, state media reported, crashed near the city of Barzagan around 1 p.m. local time in bad weather and thick fog. Search and rescue teams scoured an area of tall mountains and dense forests through rain and fog for more than 10 hours. At one point, the authorities called off the aerial search because of the weather, dispatching foot soldiers, elite commandos of the Revolutionary Guards, and 40 rescue teams to locate the crash site. Even well into the night, state media had not yet reported on casualties or on the condition of the president or anyone else aboard. The cause of the crash was also unknown. Quote, there will be no disruption in the country's operation, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said in an address on state TV. Quote, senior officials are doing their work, and I have advised them on the necessary points, and all of the country's operation will carry on smoothly and orderly, end quote. And there's a photograph looking into a men's wardrobe shop. And against the far wall is a TV monitor showing the news, and the caption says, following the news of the Iranian president's helicopter accident in Tehran on Sunday. Mr. Raisi, a conservative who violently crushed dissent, is widely viewed as a possible successor to the supreme leader. The uncertainty over his fate comes during a particularly tumultuous period for Iran. Its long shadow war with Israel burst into the open after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, setting off the war in Gaza and a cascade of strikes and counterstrikes across the region. The hostilities became even more pronounced after Israel conducted airstrikes on a building in the Iranian embassy complex in Syria in April. Iran retaliated with its first direct attack on Israel after decades of enmity, launching more than 300 drones and missiles toward the country, many of which were shot down. Domestically, Iran is also facing widespread anger, with many residents calling for an end to clerical rule. Corruption and sanctions have gutted the economy, stoking frustrations. In the last 2 years, the country has witnessed a domestic uprising, the Iranian currency plunging to a record low, water shortages intensified by climate change, and the deadliest terrorist attack since the 1979 founding of the Islamic Republic. And we see two maps, one showing where the helicopter went down in a large area, and another topographical map showing the search area. The first says source Iranian state and semi-official news agencies, and the second says by Charlie Smart and Lauren Leatherby. If the president dies, the vice president takes over, and elections must be organized within 50 days, said Ali Vaez, the Iran director of International Crisis Group, an independent conflict prevention agency. That, he said, would be, quote, a major challenge for a country that is in the midst of a severe crisis of legitimacy at home and daggers drawn with Israel and the United States in the region, end quote. Mr. Raisi is a hardline religious cleric who came of age during the country's Islamic Revolution. Under Iran's theocratic system, Mr. Raisi, as president, is the second most powerful individual in Iran's political structure after the supreme leader, Mr. Khamenei. After becoming president in 2021, Mr. Raisi consolidated power and marginalized reformists who wanted to defuse tensions with the West. He repeatedly said that he pursued a policy of, quote, strong diplomacy, end quote, forging closer economic and security ties with Russia and China. And there's a photograph of the helicopter taking off. And the caption says, in a photo provided by Islamic Republic News Agency, the helicopter carrying Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi took off at the Iranian border with Azerbaijan by Ali Hamed Hagdost. During Mr. Raisi's tenure, Iran continued to expand its regional influence, backing proxies across the Middle East that have conducted strikes against Israel and the United States, as well as advancing the country's nuclear program. In the same period, Mr. Raisi oversaw a sweeping and deadly crackdown on domestic protesters, many of them women and young people, who had taken to the streets against the country's ruling clerics. Rights groups said hundreds of protesters were killed by the nation's security forces. Mr. Raisi has been viewed as one of the frontrunners to succeed Mr. Khamenei as supreme leader. One of his main rivals for that role is the son of Mr. Khamenei. Despite the crash, some analysts said they did not expect a major change in Iran's agenda abroad. The nation's supreme leader is responsible for setting all of the country's policies, analysts said, while the president's power comes from enacting those decisions. And there's a photograph of people lining up in a hallway, and the caption says, people gather to pray for the Iranian president, by Rosh Kamushi. Quote, at one level, the outcome does not portend a sea change in how Iran formulates and acts upon its interests abroad, end quote, said Ali Vaez, the Iran director for the International Crisis Group. Quote, it is the supreme leader who makes strategic decisions about foreign policy, albeit informed by the views of other key stakeholders, including the president, end quote. Mr. Abdullahian, the foreign minister, has been heavily involved in the regional diplomacy with Arab countries. In recent months, he had also met in Qatar with leaders of the militant groups backed by Iran, including Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, the group that led the October 7th attack against Israel. He was also engaged in secret, indirect talks with the United States in February and in May in Oman to discuss diffusing tensions and relieving sanctions related to Iran's nuclear program. Biden draws on themes of manhood and faith at Morehouse commencement. The president's appearance at the historically black college in Atlanta drew some respectful but noticeable protest over U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. And there's an image from a video titled, Biden Calls on Morehouse College Graduates to Defend Democracy. And it shows the president at a podium in front of Morehouse alumni. And the caption says, in a commencement speech at Morehouse, the historically black men's college in Atlanta, President Biden condemned white supremacy and, quote, extremist forces aligned against the meaning and message of Morehouse, end quote, by Michael A. McCoy. By Katie Rogers and Maya King. Katie Rogers and Maya King reported from the Morehouse College commencement ceremony in Atlanta. President Biden invoked scripture and lessons from his own tragic past on Sunday in a commencement address to hundreds of young black men at Morehouse College, saying he believes there are, quote, extremist forces aligned against the meaning and message, end quote, of the prestigious institution. Mr. Biden's speech, delivered at the historically black men's college in Atlanta, put him directly in front of hundreds who represent a slice of the electorate that is drifting away from him over the war in Gaza and growing apathy about their choices ahead of the election. Mr. Biden used the moment to say that manhood was not about quote-unquote tough talk and quote-unquote bigotry, but about calling out hate. Quote, their idea of being a man is toxic, end quote, Mr. Biden told the graduates, of reference to adversaries he did not name, but given that his other events this weekend were focused on attacking his Republican competitor, Donald J. Trump, it was little mystery who he was talking about. Quote, that is not you. That is not us. Being a man is about strength and respect and dignity, end quote. Those who stormed the Capitol with Confederate flags, quote, are called patriots by some, end quote, he said, a clear reference to Mr. Trump. Quote, not in my house, end quote. Mr. Biden's speech was his first significant appearance before college students since protests over the war in Gaza began broiling campuses. For a ceremony in which students are discouraged even from decorating their caps, the signs of protest were respectful but noticeable. A small group of graduates turned to sit with their backs to Mr. Biden as he spoke, and several graduates wore the keffiyeh, a traditional scarf associated with the Palestinians, draped over their shoulders. Some parents urged their graduating sons not to protest. Mr. Biden also called for an immediate ceasefire and said that his administration was working to secure one. He said that members of his family had been upset by the war, a group that includes Jill Biden, the First Lady, who has urged her husband in private to bring a stop to it. Quote, what's happening in Gaza, in Israel, is heartbreaking, end quote, Mr. Biden said. Quote, it's a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, end quote. In a statement, Morehouse said that discussions between White House officials and students, faculty, and alumni had helped shape Mr. Biden's speech and his calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. The school also praised its graduates. Quote, it is fitting that a moment of organized, peaceful activism would occur on our campus while the world is watching to continue a critical conversation, end quote, the statement read. During his 27-minute speech, Mr. Biden tried to stress to the graduates, none of whom stood for him as he took the lectern, that throughout his life he had respected and espoused the same ideas they care about. He said he had worked throughout his life as a public defender, senator, and president to correct inequalities. He outlined the work his administration has done that he and his advisors believe deserves more credit than it receives, including the forgiveness of large amounts of student loan debt and reducing the poverty rate for Black children. Quote, we know Black history is American history, end quote, Mr. Biden said at one point, urging the crowd to, quote, check my record, end quote, which includes choosing the first Black female Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and the first Black woman to hold the vice presidency, Kamala Harris. By focusing on matters of adversity and strength, Mr. Biden also sought to strike a contrast with Mr. Trump, not on the grounds of politics or policy, but through the lessons of keeping faith in moments of hopelessness. He spoke of the death of his first wife and daughter, as well as his eldest son, Beau, from brain cancer. He told the Morehouse graduates, a class that weathered the chaos of the pandemic and the tumult of widespread protests over police killings of Black men, that it was natural for them to question whether there was a place for them in democracy at all. Quote, what is democracy when Black men are being killed in the streets, end quote, he said. Quote, what is democracy when a trail of broken promises still leave Black communities behind? What is democracy when you have to be 10 times better than anyone else to get a fair shot, end quote. Repeatedly, Mr. Biden reached for religious inspiration, recalling that Jesus was buried on Friday and resurrected on Sunday, leaving Saturday as a day of hopelessness. He suggested that 2020, the year he was elected, with its twin traumas of the COVID-19 pandemic and the police killing of George Floyd, had been one such Saturday. At one point, Mr. Biden said, quote, I've learned there was no easy optimism, but by faith you can find redemption, end quote. Mr. Biden, who has a bust of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the Oval Office, and who is old enough to have shared his memories of Dr. King's assassination in his speech, walked into commencement on Sunday unsure of how the crowd would receive him. Morehouse, which was established in Atlanta in 1867, is a school whose culture is steeped in tradition. Students spend their years working toward becoming the embodiment of the Morehouse man, well-traveled, well-read, and civically engaged. As the alma mater of Dr. King, there is also a proud history of protesting for social justice. Mr. Biden's visit to Morehouse drew the objections of some faculty members, alumni, and students, who have voiced anger over the war in Gaza and the American government's support for Israel. The tension drew so much attention that the school's president, David A. Thomas, publicly warned that he would stop the commencement if graduates shouted at the president or disrupted the event. The men of Morehouse found ways to work their opposition to the war into the ceremony. D'Angelo Jeremiah Fletcher, the class valedictorian, took the stage with the Palestinian flag pinned on his stole and on his cap. Quote, "It is my stance, as a Morehouse man, nay, as a human being, to call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip," end quote, Mr. Fletcher said. Mr. Biden joined the crowd in standing up and clapping when Mr. Fletcher finished, and he shook the graduate's hand. But by the end of Mr. Biden's speech, signs of support were visible, too. As Mr. Biden received an honorary doctorate of law, Mr. Thomas praised the president for listening to the concerns of the graduating class. And some people chanted, quote, unquote, four more years, as Mr. Biden left the stage. After addressing Morehouse, Mr. Biden was set to travel to Detroit to speak at a dinner hosted by the NAACP. Hitting two battleground states in 8 hours was the clearest sign yet that Mr. Biden is serious about reintroducing himself to voters who carried him to the White House in 2020 and whose support he will need to win to stay in office for a second term. In 2020, 95% of Black women and 87% of Black men voted for Mr. Biden, according to the Pew Research Center. But in April, only 55% of Black voters told Pew that they approved of his job performance. A recent poll by Ipsos and the Washington Post showed that 62% of Black Americans plan to vote in 2024, down from 74% in 2020. In recent days, both Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris have traveled outside of Washington to host events geared toward bringing those voters back into the fold. Mr. Biden's trip to Detroit comes as the latest New York Times Siena College poll shows him winning support from less than half of Black voters in Michigan in a five-way race. In 2020, he won more than 90% of Black voters in the state, exit polls show. The war in Gaza and concerns about the economy are driving factors behind what analysts say is an increase in apathy. In Michigan, nearly 9 in 10 Black voters rated the economy as being in quote-unquote fair or quote-unquote poor condition, a higher rate than white voters, the Times Siena poll found. Alexis Wiley, the founder of a strategic communications firm in Detroit, and a former member of the Democratic National Committee, said the Biden administration had to do more to communicate its victories. Quote, "I think that they're finally catching up to the fact that people aren't feeling great," end quote, Ms. Wiley said. Quote, "And now there's this mad dash to try to correct it," end quote. Quote, "We'll see you at your house," end quote. How fear and menace are transforming politics. Public officials from Congress to City Hall are now regularly subjected to threats of violence. It's changing how they do their jobs. And there's a close-up photograph of Representative Haskin sitting at a desk. And the caption says, "Representative Jamie Haskin, Democrat of Maryland, played a leading role in the former President Donald Trump's second impeachment hearing." By Danny Hakim, Ken Basinger, and Eileen Sullivan. One Friday last month, Jamie Raskin, a Democratic congressman from Maryland, spent a chunk of his day in court securing a protective order. It was not his first. Mr. Raskin, who played a leading role in Donald J. Trump's second impeachment hearing, said he received about 50 menacing calls, emails, and letters every month they're turned over to the Capitol Police. His latest court visit was prompted by a man who showed up at his house and screamed in his face about the COVID-19 vaccine, Mr. Trump's impeachment, and gender-related surgeries. Nearly 2 years earlier, the same man, with his 3-year-old son in his arms, had yelled profanities at Mr. Raskin at a July 4th parade, according to a police report. Quote, I told the judge, I don't care about him getting jail time. He just needs some parenting lessons, end quote, Mr. Raskin said. Mr. Raskin was far from the only government official staring down the uglier side of public service in America in recent weeks. Since late March, bomb threats closed libraries in Durham, North Carolina, Reading, Massachusetts, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and suspended operations at a courthouse in Franklin County, Pennsylvania. In Bakersfield, California, an activist protesting the war in Gaza was arrested after telling city council members, quote, we'll see you at your house. We'll murder you, end quote. A Florida man was sentenced to 14 months in prison for leaving a voicemail message promising to, quote, come kill, end quote, Chief Justice John Roberts. And Mr. Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, refused to rule out violence if he were to lose in November. Quote, it always depends on the fairness of the election, end quote, he said in an interview late last month. This was just a typical month in American public life, where a steady undercurrent of violence and physical risk has become a new normal. From City Hall to Congress, public officials increasingly describe threats and harassment as a routine part of their jobs, often masked by online anonymity and propelled by extreme political views. The barrage of menace has changed how public officials do their work, terrified their families, and driven some from public life altogether. By almost all measures, the evidence of this trend is striking. Last year, more than 450 federal judges were targeted with threats, a roughly 150% increase from 2019, according to the United States Marshals Service. The U.S. Capitol Police investigated more than 8,000 threats to members of Congress last year, up more than 50% from 2018. The agency recently added 3 full-time prosecutors to handle the volume. More than 80% of local officials said they had been threatened or harassed, according to a survey conducted in 2021 by the National League of Cities. Quote, people are threatening not just the prosecutor, the special counsel, the judge, but also family members, end quote, said Ronald L. Davis, director of the U.S. Marshals Service. Lisa Monaco, the deputy attorney general, said she saw, quote, an environment where disagreement is increasingly tipping over, end quote, into, quote, violent threats, end quote. It is still rare for those threats to tip into action, experts said, but such instances have increased. Some captured national attention for weeks. The mass shootings at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018 and the Tops Friendly Supermarket in Buffalo in 2022 were both carried out by perpetrators who expressed extreme right-wing views. Mr. Trump's supporters' riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, was one of the largest acts of political violence in modern American history. And there's a photograph from that day showing people arrayed over the Capitol and the steps waving American flags and other flags. And the caption says, Trump's supporters riot on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Others, including an Ohio man's shootout with state troopers after the FBI searched Mr. Trump's home, and shootings at the homes of Democratic officials in New Mexico, fall out of the headlines quickly. Surveys have found increasing public support for politicized violence among both Republicans and Democrats in recent years. A study released last fall by the University of California, Davis, found that nearly 1 in 3 respondents considered violence justified to advance some political objectives, including, quote, to stop an election from being stolen, end quote. Quote, although actual acts of political violence in America are still quite low compared to some other countries, we're now in a position where there has been enough violence that the threats are credible, end quote, said Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace who studies political violence. Violence and the threat of it has been a part of American politics since the nation's founding. But experts describe this moment as particularly volatile, thanks in great part to social media platforms that can amplify anonymous outrage, spread misinformation and conspiracy theories, and turn a little-known public employee into a target. No politician has harnessed the ferocious power of those platforms like Mr. Trump. The former president has long used personal attacks as a strategy to intimidate his adversaries. As he campaigns to return to the White House, he has turned that tactic on the judges and prosecutors involved in his various legal cases, all of whom have subsequently been threatened. Democrats, by and large, have been the loudest voices in trying to quell political violence, although many on the right have accused them of insufficiently condemning unruly left-wing protesters on college campuses and at the homes of Supreme Court justices. After Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, warned in 2020 that Supreme Court justices would, quote, pay the price, end quote, if they eliminated federal abortion rights, Chief Justice Roberts called the statement, quote, unquote, dangerous. Researchers say the climate of intimidation is thriving on political division and trust and distrust, and feeding off other social ills, including mental illness, addiction, and prejudice. Women are more commonly threatened than men, as are people of color, according to a Princeton University survey of local officials. There is little research on the political views of those behind the onslaught of abuse. Some surveys show that Republican office holders are more likely to report being targeted, often from members of their own party. Research does show, however, that recent acts of political violence are more likely to be carried out by perpetrators aligned with right-wing causes and beliefs. Public officials at all levels are changing how they do their jobs in response. Many report feeling less willing to run again or seek higher office, and some are reluctant to take on controversial issues. Turnover among election workers has spiked since 2020. Even librarians describe feeling vulnerable. Quote, these attacks are not coming from people who are looking for solutions, end quote, said Clarence Anthony, the executive director of the National League of Cities. Quote, they're looking for confrontation, end quote. Joe Cimenti started getting death threats about a year after he took office as chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Shasta County, California, in 2019. The normally sleepy county in Northern California had been thrown into tumult by a wave of anti-government sentiment that started with the coronavirus pandemic. It grew worse after Mr. Trump falsely claimed that the 2020 election had been stolen. And there's a photograph of Mr. Cimenti. And the caption says, Joe Cimenti stepped down as a chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Shasta County, California. Tired of violent threats and constant disruptions at meetings, Mr. Cimenti, a Republican, decided not to run for a second term. Elected in his place was a man who had repeated conspiracy theories about voting machines and who tried to hire a county executive who had called on Shasta County to secede from California. Mr. Cimenti said he'd had enough of the abuse. Quote, I got into this to make a difference, but I thought, why do I want to put up with this? End quote. Quote, I just don't answer my phone, end quote. And there's a photograph of a man sitting in an office, a home office. And the caption says, Fred Upton, who served as a Republican representative from Michigan for 36 years, Fred Upton, who served as a Republican representative from Michigan for 36 years, was used to taking heat from the public. But he had never experienced anything like the backlash from his decision to vote to impeach Mr. Trump for his role in the January 6th Capitol attack. He received so many threats that he asked the local police to set up motion-activated cameras outside his home in Michigan. He installed panic buttons in his district offices and stopped notifying the public in advance of his speaking engagements. He also added a second exit door to his office, his house office in Washington, in case he or his staff needed to escape from an intruder. After he voted in favor of President Biden's infrastructure bill in late 2021, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a fellow Republican, called him a traitor and posted his office number on her social media accounts. Quote, "I hope you die," end quote, one caller said in a voicemail message he received soon after. Quote, "I hope everybody in your expletive family dies," end quote. When Mr. Upton left office after his district was redrawn, he assumed the threats would stop. But he continues to receive menacing calls and letters at his home in western Michigan. Quote, "I just don't answer my phone anymore, ever," end quote, he said. Political violence in America is not new. Left-wing activists set off bombs in the Capitol in 1983 and 1971. Five lawmakers were shot by Puerto Rican nationalists in the House chamber in 1954. A pro-German professor planted a bomb in a Senate reception room in 1915. Four presidents have been assassinated. For decades after the Civil War, it was common for white Southerners to threaten Republican lawmakers, said Kate Mazur, a professor of history at Northwestern University. Quote, "It's hard for us to imagine how violent the United States was in the 19th century," end quote. But researchers view the internet as a new accelerant. Nearly three-quarters of all threats are not made in person, according to a recent Princeton analysis, making it difficult for law enforcement to identify the source. Technology has facilitated other forms of often anonymous harassment as well. Quote-unquote swatting, making hoax 911 calls designed to set off a police response to a target's house, has become more common, with a spate of recent incidents involving lawmakers, mayors, judges, and the special counsel investigating Mr. Trump. In January, Jay Ashcroft, the Republican Secretary of State in Missouri, was ordered from his house at gunpoint by armed officers responding to a bogus call that there had been a shooting at his home. No one has been charged in the event. Quote-unquote doxing, or publishing personal information online, thus giving people an opportunity to harass or threaten, has been used against a wide range of public officials and even jurors in the Trump cases. For federal lawmakers, the prospect of physical harm has long been part of the job, one that was painfully illustrated by the shooting in 2011 that gravely wounded Gabby Giffords, then an Arizona congresswoman, and by the assault on the Republican congressional baseball team in 2017 by a gunman upset by Mr. Trump's election. On Friday, the man who had broken into the home of Nancy Pelosi, the former House Speaker, and bludgeoned her husband with a hammer, was sentenced to 30 years in prison. Many public officials say they have become accustomed to managing their fears and insist they are not affected, but there is evidence that the threats and intimidation can influence decisions. Senator Mitt Romney, a Republican from Utah who is retiring at the end of this year, told a biographer that some GOP lawmakers voted not to impeach and convict Mr. Trump after the January 6th attack because they were afraid for their safety if they crossed his supporters. Mr. Romney did not identify the legislators by name and declined an interview for this article. Andrew Hitt, the former head of the Republican Party in Wisconsin, agreed to go along with the Trump campaign's failed scheme to overturn the 2020 election because he was, quote, "scared to death," end quote, he told 60 Minutes. Quote, "It was not a safe time," end quote, he said. quote, who is the worst, end quote. And there's a photograph of Mr. Trump standing in the courthouse hallway, addressing cameras and surrounded by law enforcement. The caption says, Mr. Trump has been relentless in attacking the judges overseeing his criminal and civil cases, by Doug Mills. 4 days after Mr. Trump was indicted in August in a federal election interference case, the presiding judge, Tanya S. Chutkan, received an alarming voicemail message at her chambers. Quote, if Trump doesn't get elected in 2024, we are coming to kill you, end quote, the caller said, according to court documents. Investigators tracked the message to Abigail Jo Shree, a 43-year-old Texas woman who was already facing state charges related to similar threats against two Texas state senators, a Democrat and a Republican. Ms. Shree has a history of drug and alcohol abuse and, quote, gets all her information from the internet, end quote, her father testified. Quote, you can get anything you want off the internet, and, you know, it will work you up, end quote. Ms. Shree's lawyer declined to comment. Mr. Trump has been relentless in attacking the judges overseeing the criminal and civil cases that have confronted him of late. Last month, he asked, quote, who is the worst, most evil, and most corrupt judge, end quote, in a social media post that named the judges. They are being inundated. At least three of them, including Judge Chutkan, have been swatted. In February, a woman was sentenced to 3 years in prison for threatening Judge Aileen Cannon, who is overseeing the federal criminal case against Mr. Trump involving mishandling classified documents. Last month, a resident of Lancaster, New York, pleaded guilty to making death threats against Judge Arthur F. Engeron, who presided over a civil fraud trial against Mr. Trump in Manhattan this year, as well as threats against Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who brought the case. The judges have been clear that Mr. Trump's posts make an impact. Quote, when defendant has publicly attacked individuals, including on matters related to this case, those individuals are consequently threatened and harassed, end quote, Judge Chutkan wrote in a gag order trying to limit Mr. Trump's public remarks. The prospect of being a target for abuse has already deterred some from participating in cases involving Mr. Trump. During a February court hearing in Atlanta, former Governor Roy Barnes of Georgia, a Democrat, said that Fani T. Willis, the district attorney of Fulton County, had asked him to lead the prosecution of Mr. Trump for election interference in Georgia. Mr. Barnes declined, explaining, quote, I wasn't going to live with bodyguards for the rest of my life, end quote. Ms. Willis has left her home amid threats, and the county pays about $4,000 a month for her new housing. Her staff was outfitted with bulletproof vests. This month, a Californian was indicted after threatening in the comment section of a YouTube video to kill her, quote, like a dog, end quote. Intimidation close to home. And there's a photograph of a woman sitting at her office desk. And the caption says, Natalie Adona, the county clerk and recorder in Nevada County, California. Local officials are feeling the pressure. Election officials, from secretaries of state to poll workers, have faced hostility and abuse after Mr. Trump's false claims of fraud in the 2020 election, leading to resignations and difficulty recruiting and retaining staff members and volunteers. Such threats, quote, endanger our democracy itself, end quote, Attorney General Merrick Garland said this week. Local libraries have also become targets amid a heated campaign to ban books and cancel events aimed at members of the LGBTQ community. Bomb threats were reported by 32 of the American Library Association's members' institutions last year, compared with 2 the year before and none in 2021. Carolyn Foote, a retired librarian in Austin, Texas, who co-founded a group that supports librarians, said her members had become used to being called, quote, pedophile, groomer, pornographer, end quote. Proving that ugly and hostile language has crossed the line from First Amendment-protected speech to credible threat can be difficult. Experts say prosecutions have become even harder last year after the Supreme Court raised the bar for what qualifies as credible threat, ruling that the person making the threat has to, quote, have some subjective understanding of the threatening nature of his statements, end quote. In Bakersfield, California, a lawyer for Viddy Patel, the activist who spoke of murdering city council members after urging them to take up a Gaza ceasefire resolution, said her statement was not a crime. She's pleaded not guilty to 21 felony charges. Quote, it's clear that this was not a true criminal threat, which, under California law, must be, among other things, credible, specific, immediate, and unconditional, end quote, said Peter Kang, the public defender of Kern County, which includes Bakersfield. Quote, instead, what we hear are Ms. Patel's strong, passionate expressions, which fall within the bounds of constitutionally protected speech, end quote. Local officials say they have become accustomed to dealing with vitriol and anger that they can do little about. In Nevada County, California, Natalie Adona, the county clerk and recorder, said employees received a barrage of threats in 2020 from people who did not accept the election results, and again in 2022 over a mask mandate. Ms. Adona said the county secured a restraining order against one of three people who forced their way into the building, but her staff has had to learn to endure and defuse confrontations. Quote, a lot of what we have experienced falls into this gray area, end quote, Ms. Adona said. Quote, it makes you look over your shoulder, end quote. As Trump trial nears its end, the law may give prosecutors an edge. The former president's defense appeared to chip away at Michael Cohen's credibility, but legal experts said the case is still the prosecution's to lose. There's a photograph of Mr. Trump standing in the hallway of the courthouse holding a sheaf of papers with his lawyer standing next to him and people, including police, standing behind him. The caption says, former President Donald J. Trump, with his lawyer Todd Blanche beside him, spoke to reporters after Mr. Blanche cross-examined Michael D. Cohen last week. Photo pool by Mike Seeger. By Ben Protas and Jonah E. Bromwich. Over the course of a month-long criminal trial, the evidence against Donald J. Trump has piled up. A recording of his voice directing a fixer to pay in cash. Phone calls, text messages, emails, and a photograph that illustrate the case against him. And a parade of 18 witnesses who together told the prosecution's story that Mr. Trump orchestrated a conspiracy to suppress sex scandals during the 2016 election and, after winning, sought to bury a porn star's story for good. But the 19th and final witness of their case, the only one to directly link Mr. Trump to the 34 business records he's charged with falsifying, is Michael D. Cohen. And for prosecutors, he was always high reward, high risk. Though Mr. Cohen got off to a strong start, Mr. Trump's lawyer eventually hammered his credibility, highlighting his criminal record and painting him as a serial liar bent on taking down the former president. It was the most significant momentum swing of the first criminal trial of an American president. And with Mr. Cohen's star turn on the stand poised to conclude on Monday, the prosecution's case would seem to hang in the balance. Mr. Trump's legal team argues that it is preposterous to have built a case that could hinge on Mr. Cohen's credibility. But as the trial enters its final stage, the focus shifts from the lawyers at the lectern to the 12 silent New Yorkers who will determine Mr. Trump's fate. Several legal experts say the case remains the prosecution's to lose. Between the reams of circumstantial evidence and some very favorable laws underpinning the charges, The Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, has retained inherent advantages. And so, whatever the jurors think of Mr. Cohen, truth-teller, fabulous, or something in between, the prosecution did not need them to believe his every word. Mark F. Skoll, who served in the district attorney's office for nearly four decades and worked on dozens of cases that included the false records charge, said prosecutors have checked all the legal boxes. Quote, if the jury chooses to believe the government's evidence, then a conviction is warranted, end quote, he said, though he'd noted Mr. Cohen, with all his baggage, quote, remains the linchpin, end quote, of the case. Quote, the jury does not have to believe all of what Cohen has to say, but they have to believe enough of it, end quote. A felon who self-identified as Mr. Trump's former, quote, unquote, thug, Mr. Cohen led jurors on a guided tour of the shady dealings that are the crux of the case. He told jurors that, at his boss's behest, he paid off the porn star Stormy Daniels on the eve of the election, silencing her story of a sexual liaison with Mr. Trump. Once Mr. Trump was elected, he agreed to repay Mr. Cohen the $130,000 hush money deal and more. To keep the cover-up alive, Mr. Cohen said, Mr. Trump's company disguised the reimbursement as ordinary legal expenses that arose from a retainer agreement. And at a meeting in the Trump Tower just weeks before he was sworn in, Mr. Trump signed off on the fakery, Mr. Cohen recounted from the stand. Quote, what, if anything, did Mr. Trump say at that time, end quote, a prosecutor asked Mr. Cohen. Quote, he approved it, end quote, Mr. Cohen replied, noting that Mr. Trump then added, quote, this is going to be one heck of a ride in D.C., end quote. Mr. Trump, who faces probation or up to 4 years in prison, is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, one for each purportedly bogus document, 11 checks to Mr. Cohen, 11 invoices submitted by Mr. Cohen, and 12 entries in Mr. Trump's ledger. Mr. Cohen's testimony that Mr. Trump, quote, unquote, approved the plan could give prosecutors what they need. It might not matter that he did not accuse Mr. Trump of personally falsifying the records or explicitly instructing anyone to do so. Under the New York law that Mr. Trump is charged with violating, prosecutors need only show that he, quote, unquote, caused his company to file false records. And there's a photograph of Mr. Cohen getting out of the car, and there's somebody with a microphone standing right next to him. And the caption says, Michael D. Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, was the prosecution's star witness. The prosecution has another legal card to play. The law holds a defendant accountable even when he does not carry out the crime himself, so long as he, quote unquote, intentionally aids it. The issue was highlighted during jury selection when a prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, asked prospective jurors whether they could accept the idea that a husband who hired a hitman to kill his wife was guilty of her murder. Many agreed they could. And as a final way to buttress their case, prosecutors might invoke a 2016 appeals court decision upholding the conviction of a defendant who did not handle or approve the false records in question, ruling that it was, quote unquote, reasonably foreseeable that his actions would have resulted in the filing of false records. The case could hang on Justice Juan M. Merchant's interpretation of these issues, the legal experts said. In the coming days, Justice Merchant, the judge overseeing the case, will distill the legalities into instructions for jurors that he will deliver after closing arguments as soon as this week. The instructions, the experts said, could support the prosecution's view of the case. Quote, the judge's instructions provide a roadmap to the jurors, end quote, said Mr. Scholl, the former prosecutor, noting that, quote, Trump does not have to be the one who says, make that record false, end quote. But some jurors could arrive at the same conclusion that Mr. Trump's supporters had pushed, that the roundabout nature of the charges do not justify the first felony conviction of a former president. Felony counts of falsifying business records require prosecutors to show that a defendant sought to conceal a second crime. And in this case, the prosecutors have laid out that second crime in graphic detail, arguing that in 2015, Mr. Trump entered into conspiracy with Mr. Cohen and the publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, to conceal the sex scandals. Mr. Pecker, the trial's first witness, testified that he had agreed to suppress several damaging stories on Mr. Trump's behalf as he ran for president, including a former Playboy model's story of an affair. Mr. Pecker told the jury that for $150,000, he bought and buried the model's story. And on a surreptitious recording Mr. Cohen made on his phone, jurors heard Mr. Trump directing that they repay Mr. Pecker. Other witnesses, including Hope Hicks, Mr. Trump's former spokeswoman, underscored the threat that the stories posed to the campaign. She also testified that the candidate was in touch with both Mr. Pecker and Mr. Cohen as the campaign sought to contain the scandals, a recollection corroborated by phone records. In closing arguments, the defense will likely cast those machinations as typical presidential political tactics. They are also expected to argue that Mr. Trump had nothing to do with the records at the heart of the case, which they have already characterized as a sort of back office paperwork that a president would never bother touching. Yet jurors learned that Mr. Trump signed 9 of the 11 checks himself, and prosecutors introduced a variety of other circumstantial evidence regarding the documentation. Mr. Trump's former employees portrayed him as a micromanager who was detailed obsessed when it came to his own money and paid close attention to checks that came in and out of his office. His own books emphasize that point. Quote, penny pinching, end quote, he wrote in one of them. Quote, you bet, I'm all for it, end quote. To directly link Mr. Trump to the false records, though, prosecutors called Mr. Cohen to the stand. His story began a decade before the documents even existed. Composed and steady on the stand, he recounted his professional life as a New York tragedy in miniature, a man who met, then served his idol, only to be betrayed and imprisoned after the porn star payoff in October 2016, which could have been his proudest moment. 3 months after striking the deal with Ms. Daniels, Mr. Cohen said he had a crucial meeting at Trump Tower. There, he said, Mr. Trump's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, explained how Mr. Trump would reimburse Mr. Cohen for the payoff. Mr. Weisselberg took notes, which prosecutors showed to the jury, and Mr. Cohen testified that Mr. Trump signed off on the specifics. In one word of all important testimony, a simple quote-unquote yes, Mr. Cohen confirmed that his boss had known the records which falsely described the repayments as legal expenses arising from a fictional legal quote-unquote retainer. Mr. Cohen, who pleaded guilty in 2018 to a variety of federal crimes, including some related to the hush money, asserted that there was no retainer agreement that he had not accrued any legal expenses. Quote, was this invoice a false record, end quote? A prosecutor, Susan Hoffinger, asked Mr. Cohen on Tuesday. Quote, yes, ma'am, end quote, he confirmed, and added that the check stubs were fake as false as well. Asked the purpose of the checks, he explained that, in part, they represented, quote, the reimbursement to me for the hush money fee, end quote. It was exactly what prosecutors hoped jurors would hear. But now, after 2 days of cross-examination and more to come on Monday, they must hold on and hope the jury will believe it. Under cross-examination, a lawyer for Mr. Trump, Todd Blanche, did all he could to call Mr. Cohen's credibility into doubt. He highlighted lies the former fixer had told while under oath in the past, insisting that he had lied again when answering questions from prosecutors in the current trial. In a particularly tense line of questioning, Mr. Blanche sought to impeach Mr. Cohen's earlier testimony that he had spoken to Mr. Trump in October 16 about the payment to Ms. Daniels. To reach Mr. Trump, Mr. Cohen testified, he called the candidate's bodyguard, Keith Schiller. But Mr. Blanche, noting that Mr. Cohen had been the target of a harassment campaign from a teenager around the same time, proposed an alternate theory. He described text messages that suggested the fixer was calling Mr. Schiller to complain that he was being bullied by a 14-year-old prank caller, and not to speak to Mr. Trump about the payment. Quote, "You did not talk to President Trump on that night. You talked to Keith Schiller," end quote, Mr. Blanche said, raising his voice and his index finger. Quote, "You can admit it," end quote. But Mr. Cohen remained composed and held firm. Quote, "No, sir, I can't," end quote, he responded. "Take my wife, please. For political damage, just blame your spouse." When Justice Samuel Alito and Senator Bob Menendez landed in hot water, they looked for a scapegoat to close to home. Inside their homes, in fact. And there's a photograph of Senator Bob Menendez and his wife walking down a street, followed by reporters and security. And the caption says, "Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey and his wife, Nadine Menendez, have been charged with accepting lavish gifts in exchange for political favors." Photo by Jefferson Siegel. By Rebecca Davis O'Brien and Reed J. Epstein. It's a tale as old as Adam and Eve. A husband faced with accusations of misconduct blames his wife. It's also a time-honored bipartisan political strategy. This week, Justice Samuel A. Alito Jr. and Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey pointed ringed fingers at their wives for episodes that have landed each man in political or legal trouble. Quote, "It was briefly placed by Mrs. Alito," end quote, Justice Alito, one of the Supreme Court's most conservative members, told the New York Times in explaining an upside-down American flag, a Stop the Seal symbol of protest by Donald J. Trump's supporters, flying on a pole in the family's front lawn in the days before President Biden's 2021 inauguration. The justice's wife, Martha Ann Alito, was in a feud with neighbors at the time over an anti-Trump sign, the Times reported. And that's all the time we have. This has been Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for May 20th, 2024.